Welcome to Nosecast, the Gnostic Podcast, with the Reverend Troy Pierce, where questions make heretics. Views expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker.
Ring a bell, let's still ring.
Episode 1. Is sane religion an oxymoron?
Greetings. I'm the Reverend Troy Pierce, and this is the inaugural episode of Nosecast, the Gnostic Podcast. However, there are two other Nosecast podcasts available. The first is Nosecast Meditations, an audio version of the lectionary of the Ecclesia Gnostica. The second is Nosecast Homilies, the recorded homilies delivered in the Holy Gnosis of Thomas Chapel. This episode will consist of four major sections. The first is a brief introduction, so that you will have some idea of who it is who is presenting this information to you. The second looks at the counterintuitive notion that being a Gnostic entails not knowing. The third, we begin a series looking at the nature of religion. And in the fourth, we begin an exploration of the spiritual path from a very pragmatic point of view. Each of these sections will be introduced by a different bit of theme music and occasionally a bit of exit music. Between some sections, Gnostic scriptures will be read. It is my hope that this will be of service to you, that it will begin a deepening process of considering the material, for no amount of information can give you gnosis. You must follow the path. And so, thank you for downloading and listening to this podcast, and let us begin. I grew up on the west side of the Salt Lake City area into an LDS household. My mother being very devout, my father being more nominally LDS, and very authoritarian. He also had the gift of being able to believe anything he wanted to insist on as being true. I then encountered Star Trek and Mr. Spock and logic. This gave me a means of seeing beyond the authoritarian and power-based sphere of things. There were objective standards one could apply and see what was and was not logical and what was and was not true. Other interests in early childhood were mythology, fantasy, and science fiction. These were not simply escapist, but also really quite symbolic and archetypal in their content. I had the fortune of encountering Joseph Campbell fairly early in life, and from there making the connection to Carl Gustav Jung, and making a further connection after a couple of years of study of Jung to the local Salt Lake Jung study group. which I had the privilege of participating in for many years. I studied philosophy, science, and psychology for quite some time. I enrolled in the university to study physics, ended up eventually graduating with degrees in philosophy and psychology. My spiritual path began with my study of classical mythology, and was picked up again with an encounter with Taoism, which led to Chan Buddhism and to Zen Buddhism, which I practiced for a number of years. However, this did not give me the symbolic content and the mythic story content that I yearned for so deeply, that had been so much a part of my life for so long. And so I sought the only place that seemed to hold the possibility to experience these things, and which really has become the great spiritual laboratory and place of experimentation with religion, spirituality, psychology of our age. And that is neo-paganism. I moved through the circles also for a few years, feeling less and less a part of them, and never really having felt fully a part of them, knowing that my orientation was somewhat different. It wasn't until a few years later, when studying the origins of Christianity, that I encountered Gnosticism, and finally recognized what it was that I am, which is a Gnostic. This led to a couple of years of study, during which I had the experience of a very sure and profound calling to Gnostic ministry. However, the question I immediately asked was, how? This was not answered for a little over a year when I encountered Ecclesia Gnostica and the Reverend Dr. Lance Owens, who brought this practice, the Ecclesia Gnostica, which is Latin for Gnostic Church, to the Salt Lake City area. I began attending and undergoing formation as clergy, which is a 7-year process, taking one through 5 minor orders and 3 major orders, the last one being priest. This August will mark my 4th anniversary of my ordination to the priesthood, and I currently serve as the pastor of the Holy Gnosis of Thomas Chapel in Salt Lake City, Utah. Been serving as clergy in the Salt Lake City area for all but about 2 years of the past decade, during which time I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area and worked in technology. I moved back to help take care of my father while he was dying, and also to avoid some of the expense and growing uncertainty in the tech market, which led to the collapse and subsequent loss of all possibility of employment in the technical field, really in the place in which I live now. And so here I am, by fate, by design, by choice, however you want to look at it, a full-time Gnostic priest, able to provide such things as podcast content and blog content, and to work on books, calendars, and numerous other things. And that is where I am today. Process of founding and starting the Gnosis Institute, which is a non-denominational, non-profit corporation that will serve as a contemporary center for Gnostic thought. Something like a Gnostic think tank combined with an educational institution and a research institution to help bring about a new level of Gnosticism in the modern world. Well, I could just go on and on. But tonight, I've got a headache. A Psalm of Valentinus. Harvest. I see how all hangs through spirit. I understand how all is supported by spirit. Flesh hangs on the soul. Soul hangs on the air. Air hangs on the other. From a depth
fruits arise. From a womb, a child arises. Observed by the heresiologist Hippolytus.
And everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through. From the bloody cross on top of Calvary to the beach of Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming upon. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows.
I'm sometimes asked how to become a Gnostic. My usual response to that is, everyone I've encountered, when they encounter Gnosticism, either recognize it as finally being what they are, or they don't. Yet there is more to it than that. For being a Gnostic entails not knowing almost everything. How could this be, you might ask, when you've read that Gnostic means knower, and that gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge? Well, the fact is that that is misinformation, because it is incomplete. Gnosis is not the Greek word for knowledge, it is a Greek word for knowledge. There is both gnosis and episteme. What we think of when we use the word knowledge in English is episteme, not gnosis. Facts, information, data, sorts of things one can obtain from studying of books, for example, all fits into that category of knowledge, episteme. Gnosis, on the other hand, is the type of knowledge that comes from experience. It involves recognition or acquaintance. It might best be translated as recognition of, or acquaintance with, or having experience with. The type of knowledge that the Gnostic sought, obviously, was gnosis. The type of knowledge we are familiar with is episteme. We live in what has been dubbed the information age, and there is a great deal of information around. Far too much information to actually be of use. And we are also a bit savvy about information. We know that information can be incorrect. That just because it is in print doesn't mean that it is true, even though we often fall for that anyway. This has led to our modern relativism, a notion that everything is information, and therefore no information is essentially privileged information. Privileged in the sense that it can make a stronger claim to being true than some other type of information. And while few hold this radical view, I've just used as an example, many hold a view very similar to it. Often people will hold that view along with the belief that they know a great deal, and argue, be willing to argue strongly that they know this or that. And many are willing to argue in the face of facts and evidence to the contrary, and will hold that they know something in spite of any evidence to the contrary. That type of knowing we often characterize as beliefs. One holds a belief, one claims it as knowledge, and it may be held as being privileged above sensory data or anything deriving from that, such as scientific experimentation. One's theory of knowledge, or the framework in which one understands knowledge, derives its name from that type of knowledge, episteme, and is called epistemology. It is a branch of philosophy that attempts to be clear about where knowledge comes from, the different types of knowledge, and what claims knowledge may have for being true knowledge. However, if we look at the whole of episteme, the whole of information, we can see how the entirety of it might be mistaken. We can look at Plato's Allegory of the Cave, the Matrix movies, Dark City, the Truman Show, any number of things, or the entirety of what was known either by an individual or by a number of individuals, had no foundation. It was all a matter of deceit. Having a religion based on episteme is to do what William James described as having faith in someone else's faith. What if they were wrong? If they were wrong, you will also be wrong, because you are simply accepting this information. These claims that this knowledge is true, you accept and adopt. For Gnostics, this has never been acceptable. To seek gnosis is to seek a different type of knowledge, is to seek direct acquaintanceship, recognition, to have experience with those things involved with religion. Does not mean to swap one set of beliefs for another set of beliefs, to merely trade in forms of episteme. Gnosis is something else. When one becomes a Gnostic, when one has gnosis, then one has gnosis of something. One knows in that direct way something. And knowing that contrasts what little they do know directly with how much they don't know directly. How much is simply episteme? How much might be completely mistaken? The difference is that in gnosis, one is involved. The individual person is involved, not as an object, but as a subject. The subjective is involved. There is an experience. For there to be gnosis, there must be experience or experiences of some kind. However, the experience or experiences are not in and of themselves the gnosis. Just like meeting Bob is not the same thing as knowing Bob in the sense that one could recognize Bob. And so the most important, most fundamental thing to bear in mind, if one is really seeking to follow the path of Gnosis, is that in almost every instance, we do not know, because we do not have Gnosis of that. We can look to tradition. We can look to scripture. We can look in a lot of different ways. And there's a lot of episteme knowledge we can have, and it can guide us. However, to assert that as being the truth is to make a mistake. Is to mistake episteme for gnosis. Is to mistake the map or the guidebook for the location or the journey. While they are not opposites, they are of a different sort. And while we can recognize them both as being types of knowledge, they are different types. So if you meet an expert on Gnosticism, my advice is to run. Because in general, people come to Gnosticism as experts, and if they continue to study and grow over time, they know less and less. Over time, they realize that more and more of their knowledge is not founded upon Gnosis. That more and more of what they think they know could be something that they are mistaken about. That it is only in those areas where one has Gnosis that one truly knows. So bear in mind, if you are seeking to follow the path of Gnosis to liberation, that contrary to what many might have you believe, to be a Gnostic is not to know. To be a Gnostic does not mean adding to one's current knowledge. Changing one's current knowledge in for a new current knowledge of the same sort. It means dispensing with the idea that ideas are knowledge. Digging deeper to what is a direct knowledge, to what we cannot be mistaken about. We can be mistaken about our conclusions from our experiences. We can be mistaken in how we describe or try to convey our experiences. But the reason Gnosis is a path to liberation is that one cannot be mistaken about Gnosis itself. When achieved, it is not a knowledge that one has. It is a knowledge that one is. It transforms you. And in that way, is both a transforming of who we are and a true becoming of who we are. But to be a Gnostic is not to be a know-it-all. Not one to be dead certain about things beyond their ken. It is to be someone who realizes they do not truly know most of what they thought they knew. and to go through a process and a path of uncovering more and more of what they thought they knew as being incorrect. To go on a path where gnosis is more important than episteme. Where having information over time becomes less and less important.
We are building a religion. We are building it bigger. We are widening the corridor and adding more lanes. We are building a religion, a limited edition. We are now accepting callers for these pendant keychains. Your resistance is useless. It is useless to resist it. His cigarette is burning, but he never seems to ash. He is grooming his poodle. He is living comfort evil. You can meet at his location.
Is sane religion an oxymoron? Or phrased another way, is religion by necessity something that is a bit crazy or very crazy? Something that leads human beings to be insane. The title for this series actually comes from an individual that I met, and when I was attempting to explain, as I all too infrequently try to do, that I am a Gnostic priest, this individual began to discuss the craziness associated with religion. And, seeing this as a way to explain what I'm about, I said something about trying to offer a sane religion as an alternative. To which this individual replied, "Sane religion is an oxymoron." Now that was far from the first time that this sentiment has been brought to my attention. Two other incidents come to mind. One was a number of years ago, when I was first beginning formation as clergy. And it was at a party when a friend and coworker turned to me and said, "I don't see how anyone could possibly be religious." And understanding what it was that she meant, I agreed. More recently, a number of individuals have decided to attack Gnostic religion, to make the claim that somehow Gnosticism and religion are antithetical. Others make the claim that Gnosticism and Christianity are antithetical. And if we listen in to the culture as it endlessly debates these things, there is a very large camp for which religion is seen as, if not the root of all evil, then the root of a great deal of evil. How accurate is this view? What do we mean when we talk about religion? How did our modern cultural understandings develop? And not just the one that discards religion as some sort of disease, but the worldview that upholds religion as if it were instead the panacea, the cure of all ills. What's going on here? As a Gnostic, I don't try to simply bring our prejudices to bear on a new situation, or even on an old situation. To attempt to ascertain, to discern, to get to some level of gnosis, a great deal of work is required, and we must be willing to dispense with our prejudices, to dispense with the filters through which we want to look at these things, the filters that make us feel better, that reinforce our sense of identity. For ultimately, all of that is meaningless. It is attempting to turn the world into some sort of solipsism, making the world into a reflection of what we ourselves are. We merely project what we wish to see, and then we see it. A Gnostic must look deeper. So let's begin this process of looking deeper. First, let's take the point of view of those who see religion as insane by necessity. Let us look at the claim that sane religion is an oxymoron. There is a great deal of work being done in what is usually referred to as the skeptical community to undermine or overthrow religion. The reason for this is that they perceive religion in its most irrational forms. And if we look at the world today through our media, that is what we see. Occasionally, we might see religion in a positive light. We might see the faith of someone like Bono, leading him into a deep ministry towards those suffering in Africa. But as likely as not, that religious aspect might not be reported at all. To either merely see only the bad things, the bad consequences associated with religion, or to only see the good things, the good consequences associated with religion, is to look at the world with very big blinders. Both occur. We have benefited so much more than any of us can truly comprehend from religion. For people serving out what they believe to be a religious cause. To take one non-controversial example, we can hold up the civil rights movement. Faith played a very deep part of that movement, and it led to greater freedom for so many people. And there are so many other examples we could hold up. On the other side, we could hold up a lot of bad examples as well. And often there is no need for us to hold up bad examples, because people in this world, in this day, right here, right now, are doing it for us, day in and day out. There are people who hold up the Prince of Peace and use him as a club against those they hate. There are those who condemn others with such certainty that it is terrifying. And they claim that their hatred is not their own, but they are simply carrying out the will of some all-powerful monster. In the modern development of comparative religious studies, the broad categories for looking at religion are beliefs and practices. And in our modern world, we have turned belief, faith, and religion into synonyms. We casually interchange them. A practicer of a religion is a believer. And this is not something that generally strikes people as being odd. If we look at religion as a set of beliefs and compare it to other possible sets of beliefs, then we do have a bit of a problem. as the set of beliefs posited by most religions, as we understand them, are at odds with a set of beliefs posited by experimental science. When we think of crazy religious folk, we generally think of people who hold beliefs up and against evidence to the contrary. Not simply people who hold beliefs where there is no evidence for or against, but people who hold beliefs where there is clear, measurable, definitive, and as much as things can be definitive, evidence against. Of course, the obvious example are fundamentalist literalists with the collection of scriptures usually referred to as the Bible. There are individuals who take the accounts of the creation of the world given in the first book of the Bible to be literally true, and to have such a privileged position of truth that no physical evidence can deter their belief. And so these individuals are in a position where they are forced to argue against there having been dinosaurs, for example, or being in a position of having to argue against evolution. We can also look at topics that are of great and pressing concern, where individuals look at them in exactly the same way. Their beliefs outweigh any possible evidence, and they do not entertain the possibility that their beliefs could be wrong. Our world has suffered greatly. Human beings have suffered greatly from this, and always will. So if we take that view of religion as being holding on to a set of beliefs in the face of evidence to the contrary, then we must accept the conclusion that sane religion is an oxymoron. How could holding a set of beliefs for which there is clear evidence against possibly be a sane thing? Now, you may have gone along with this argument to this point without a problem, or you may have noticed the rather large problem with this argument, and that is the assumption that religion equals beliefs, that we can simply replace religion in our equation, in our considerations, with a set of beliefs. Now, if we look around at the world, if we look more deeply through human history, this approach to religion is actually a bit odd. In our modern view, we see a distinction between religion and society and government and our understanding of the world. However, this view is really very recent and truly only fully realized as a result of the Enlightenment. For most of human history, these things are not distinct. And also, for most of human history, there was no choice between one religion or another. Not because of some forced orthodoxy, but because it never occurred to anyone that there could be any other religion. If we look at religious practices of indigenous people, we can see this much more clearly. These are not sets of beliefs. They include beliefs. They include stories. They include practices. But they are more of an entire relationship. And within that religious frame and sphere, there really isn't the emphasis on a particular creed. Rather, it is a world view, an all-encapsulating, inclusive thing, in which an individual's spiritual practices are carried out. To see religion developing into a set of beliefs, we have to go to places where distinct religious movements occurred and where these religious movements clashed. Of course, in the West, the place we think of and look to is the origin of Christianity. The reason this becomes of such great interest is because it represents a fundamental shift, an incredible change. We go from a time before the spread of Christianity when there was a particular religious worldview, classical paganism, in which polytheism was the worldview, and bringing in another god and another means of worshiping that god, a cult to that god, was not seen as being some radical new thing. In fact, it was often seen as being quite interesting. The successes of the cults of Isis and Mithras in the Romanized and Hellenized world are examples of this. In this milieu, there were the Jews, and they were tolerated as being a different people with their different practices, and they were just allowed to do their own thing separately. And so a new religious movement, growing out of Judaism and spreading across the empire, began to be perceived as a threat because it was an expansion. It was no longer that one small group of odd people doing their peculiar thing. It was a spreading, a changing, a growing. In that cauldron, Christian doctrine began to be created. The writers, usually referred to as the Church Fathers, began to write defenses of Christianity against this other worldview, which we call apologies, and we call the writers apologists, from the Greek to defend. And this particular movement within Christianity continued. Christianity, of course, was not any one particular thing, just as it isn't any one particular thing today. And so, in creating these defenses, these apologies of the Christian religion, a doctrine began to be defined. And when you define a particular doctrine, when you lay out what it is, you are also laying out what it is not. This was taken to the extreme, in the first place, by Bishop Irenaeus of Lyon. Irenaeus did not write an apology. He wrote an attack against those excluded. His famous work is Against All Heresies, Against All Wrong Ways. And he really saw this as an extension of the apologetic movement. That in defining and defending the Christian religion in the face of government-sanctioned persecution, that it was very, very important that all members of the Christian religion be on the same page as the apologists. And therefore those who were not, the so-called knowers, Gnostics, those who profess to have knowledge, gnosis, are described, ridiculed, and attempted to be dismissed in this work by Irenaeus. And this becomes another major thread in the development of orthodoxy. And so there are these two threads developing. The continuing apologetic thread, but it takes a turn and becomes this anti-heresy movement. So that in the face of persecution, the priorities were to defend the religion and to attack those who were seen as not really being a part of that religion. These threads continued. And the developing orthodoxy continued. This came to its final fruition through a process of being adopted and recognized as the official religion of the empire. If there is one thing that empires do not like, it is dissent and anything that might lead to civil war. And so various ecumenical councils were called, under the authority of the emperor, to decide and resolve various points of contention. And this process, of course, led to a very well-defined orthodoxy and a continual increase in what was considered to be heresy. The first attempts to exclude those perceived as being heretics are the creeds, statements of beliefs. It's come from credo, Latin for we believe. And it was thought that the heretics who believed something different would not be able to repeat this creed and so would be excluded from participation. However, this was found to be rather ineffective, and the creeds were further refined and expanded upon. Currently, the creed that resulted from the voting at the Council of Nicaea is considered by many to be the definition of essential Christianity. And this was just the beginning of many centuries of arguments and debates and scholarship over various aspects of belief and what was and was not orthodox belief or heretical belief. Given this context, we can see where our modern understanding of religion as beliefs comes from. There is also much more to this history. Various points during the Middle Ages, a number of groups arose that were perceived as being heretical and were suppressed, some of these being almost indistinguishable from other groups that were accepted. The Waldensians and the Franciscans come to mind. However, the difference between the two were their beliefs. The Waldensians were anti-ecclesiastical, and the Franciscans were not. The use of armies to suppress heresy began with what is usually referred to in history books as the Albigensian Crusade, because the movement of the Cathars is associated with the town of Albi in the south of France. However, it is only a few centuries from these large and bloody oppressions of heresy when we have the Protestant Reformation and a very successful heresy. Times and political players had changed, and Martin Luther was never punished for heresy. The movement itself was never effectively suppressed and grew. This was the beginning of a lot of bloody wars, the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. And all of these wars came about from differences in doctrine. And over time, the world changed into such a way that one could belong to a number of different branches of the Christian religion simultaneously existing in the same region, in the same period of history, all distinguishing themselves by having different beliefs. It is from this context that scholars in the West turn their attention through the expansion of empire to religions in the East and to indigenous religions. And it is through this understanding and filter that our modern comparative religious studies programs view the world to this day. And yet, how fundamentally accurate is this view? We will look to that question in the next episode.
Real spirituality is reality-oriented spirituality. It is practical. It is pragmatic. It begins with where you are now and extends to your experience. First thing to remember when beginning your spiritual path is that you will always be beginning your spiritual path. It's always a matter of beginning again, starting from where you are now and continuing onward. And so you have to know where you are in order to know what direction to go next. This is incredibly important. It's so easy to miss. As Zen Master Dogen wrote, a hair's breadth of difference, and heaven and earth split apart. If we, for just a moment, leave our experience, leave where we truly are, and follow ideas, follow wishful thinking, follow if only, follow notions of when this occurs, or if I can do this first, then. Only when we discard all of that can we keep that hair's breadth of difference from splitting us apart from our own experience and our own lives. Our world seeks to trap us in abstract thinking, particularly in areas of religion. We're supposed to argue about theoretical notions. We're supposed to fight, perhaps even bleed, kill, do horrible things for theoretical, abstract ideas associated with religion. Why? How important can they possibly be? They're just ways to have battles to combat between ideas. This is the meme model of religion, which an unfortunately large number of religious actions fall into. Wars of ideas. Which idea will win? Our spiritual life, we really don't have time for that. Our ideas will only lead us off track. So often we insist upon our ideas in the face of reality, leading us to contradict the real, the pragmatic, the practical, with our wishes, with our desires for the way things must be. This is utter nonsense, waste of time, waste of energy, and a horrible trap. To begin a spiritual path, you must begin where you are. There's no need for condemnation, judging. No need for judging yourself relative to where you think you should be, or others think you should be. If you are able to see where you are well on your way, and moving, growing, living. People who might have their ideas make their judgments. Do they know where they're at? It is unlikely. Someone knows truly where they are, what they have been through, what they have narrowly missed in their own lives, are not very quick to judge others based on some abstract criterion. In fact, I think you will find that everyone who is on a spiritual path is supportive of everyone else on a spiritual path. Because the important part of beginning, the important part of knowing where you're at, gives you insight. And there is a connection that seems to occur when you meet others who've gone through the process of knowing where they are at. There is kinship and a natural companionship for those on the path. So do not be guided by any idea, be it doctrine, dogma, be it negative or positive. You should no more be guided by the idea that you can accomplish anything you set out to accomplish, or that you are already perfect and complete and whole being. As you should by an idea that you are somehow fundamentally unworthy or incapable of beginning the path yourself. Where you're at is what is important, not what you think about it. And so you must be willing to discard your ideas. And so, to begin the path, as one is always beginning the path, to see where one is. Not one's ideas of where one is. And there's no value in seeing where one should, could, would have been, might be. But reach down, touch the earth, the ground of the path. See where your feet are. See where you are. Be willing to do that. And you will begin. Begin again. Continue the path. What is your path? It is the path that is calling you. The body grows and fades. The mind grows and fades. But the spirit grows and grows. So may we all know where we are truly. Without condemnation, without comparison, but to know, to have gnosis of where we are, is the beginning of the path to liberation, the gnosis of where we are going, the gnosis of who we truly are. One must begin somewhere, and the only place to begin is where you are. So begin. Begin again. Assess where you are. See what blind spots are no longer blind. See what areas you thought you were strong in, where you have become aware of your weaknesses. See the places where your limitations lie, where your strengths lie. And take heart. And go forward. For that is the way of your destiny, the way to your true home, the way to live out your true life. May you have many blessings on your journey. Amen.
For more information and resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.
Wake up.